Mm-hmm.
And just speak normal, like.
Yeah, that's
right.
Mm-hmm.
Because the last time I spoke into these things on TV, I made an awful mess. My name is Frank Logan. I was born in 1909 in the city of Newcastle on Tyne in England. My whole family are military. I have a great military background. My father, all my brothers, his father, and so on right through. I came to Canada in 1929. I was married in 1931, and at that time I joined the Canadian militia. In the Canadian Army Service Corps, where I attained the rank of Regimental Sergeant Major. However, at the outbreak of war, I had four children in the family, and my colonel wouldn't accept me for overseas services. So I asked for a discharge and went into the Grenadiers as a private. I wasn't in there too long, but with my background, I was made a warrant officer and remained a warrant officer until I was discharged. So I should have said, too, prior to coming to this country, I had served 5 years in the Durham Light Infantry, which was a British regiment.
Or did you serve Britain? Or did you
I served in Britain, North Africa, Mesopotamia, India, and China.
Mm-hmm. Were you in one of those garrison duties in China during the time that fell occupied by the British and Japanese?
Well, in China at that time, in Shanghai at that time, I was the international settlements. It was all in a sort of a circle. The British, French, Russian, German, everybody had a finger in the pie there. But we were sent there from Solon in the Murray Hills when the rebellion started in 1926. That's when the Northern Chinese came down to invade the southern area. We stayed there 6 months. We had a whale of a time.
Did you notice any action from the Japanese? Any Japanese ones? Any Japanese stuff?
Well, there were Japanese in there, yes.
Yeah. And did you notice anything that made you suspicious that they might be getting ready for a war?
Nothing at all, no.
No signs of them?
In fact, we didn't come in contact with any of the other regimental groups or brigade groups, with the exceptions of the Americans. We all had our own sectors, our own cantonments in which we had to stay. And it was only the odd time when out at night, or a nightclub or something, that we'd come in contact with the Americans. But the other nations more or less stayed in their own section and stayed together.
How was your health in those countries? How did you adjust to those
countries? Oh, quite easy. In the first, in North Africa, it gets warm. It takes a considerable period of time to get from England to where you're going. At that time, we traveled on troop ships that perhaps went 400 miles a day. And you're getting acclimatized as you go through it. I think the British more or less acclimatized to these things quite easy. The first place we went in Mesopotamia, I call it Iran now, was on the pipeline, Basra, and Baghdad, and through there. I was 110 in the shade, and we had to take right over and come and patrol the pipelines.
Was it a dry heat?
Pardon?
Was it a dry heat?
Dry, very, very dry, yes. Well, it was strictly desert.
Mm-hmm.
But the only thing that grew there were palm trees and dates, things like that. We didn't stay there long. We were taken over by the Air Force, who patrolled the pipelines and airplanes from there on in. Then we moved to India. From there, we were sent up into the Punjab. And I remained in the Punjab till we left for China.
Those type of Indians in the northern, that was in northern India, eh?
Northern India, yes.
They accustomed well to military life in the Punjabis?
Punjabis are fine. All Indian troops were a fine bunch of troops, yeah. Although we never had any dealings with them, only on maneuvers, things like that. But we never drank with them, went to the canteen with them, or anything else. The only Indian troops that were allowed in the canteen with a British soldier were the Gurkhas. And their station was mostly up on the northwest frontier.
Is it true that you played the bagpipes?
Oh yes, there's many pipers in India. I think the pipes originated in the East, the Middle East, and the Far East. Mm-hmm. Even without pipes, they have what they call a chanter. Now a chanter, in their way of doing things, is a sort of a bubble affair with a horn on the end, but it's a much lower tone than the pipes. But it's still the origination, I consider, the pipes.
Mm-hmm. What was that Afghanistan thing was long before?
Well, Afghanistan kept on going continuously. There was no let-up in Afghanistan.
There wasn't
it? No, there was always the Pathans and the Afghans. Well, the Pathans were what we call loot-wallers. They used to come over at night into the barracks and try and steal parts of rifles or whatever they could get their hands on. At that time, we always locked our rifles. We took out the bolts. The bolt was strapped to your wrist, and your bayonet strapped to your wrist. And that's where you slept. Although these Pathans have been known to go into a barracks and take the bed sheets from under a man without him feeling it. They're a funny bunch. Dogs we had plenty of around the barracks, the cantonment. But these Pathans, they call themselves cheetah fat. And the smell of the cheetah fat scares off the dogs, and instead of them barking and making a row wanting they're scared, so they go in their kennels and lay down quietly.
Very clever.
They're very clever.
How was Britain in, you called you, that work you would actually say garrison duty, would you?
Well, it was a lot of a garrison duty, yes. I mean, we were abroad, that's all.
Yeah,
that.
And Britain had a method of training men abroad to bring them into, they had a system, didn't they, of sending their soldiers abroad and training them so much in different countries?
Yes, well, you always did, you joined for 7 and 5, and you always did part of your service in a foreign station. In the Middle East, it was called at home abroad. You weren't really abroad, but once you got through the Suez Canal, well, you were abroad then. Every regiment had at least 2 battalions of regular troops, and there'd be one either at home and home abroad, and the other one would be abroad.
So by the time a man had finished those 7.5 years in the British service, he was a well-conditioned soldier, I presume.
Definitely. You had to be in order to survive, like, and draw your pay and one thing like that. The pay then was 2 nines a day. And you had to have your second-class civilian education, your good conduct, plus first-class shot and passing all weapons in order to draw the 4 shilling a day, which wasn't a great deal.
No.
But,
so, what brought you to Canada?
Well, I left the army in 1928. I left the army in October, and in Britain, as you know, from 1919, after the First World War, Britain was dead, and I lived in a heavy industrial area, and there was absolutely no work for anyone. And I couldn't see myself just sitting at home or walking the streets, which I used to do, looking for work and getting no on the door. So the next best thing was migrate. I was a toss-up whether I come to Canada or come to go to Australia. I had relatives in Australia, non-Canada, but Canada won out. I'm not sorry, really.
You came to Winnipeg, yeah?
Well, I went to Alberta first, worked on the railroads, and then I came back to Winnipeg. And I've been here ever since.
And when you came to Winnipeg, did you get work, or you just went right into Canadian service?
No, I worked. I worked at anything to put the hands on. The depression started, as you know, late 29, the early 30s. And you worked at anything you could get. Mm-hmm. So I worked most of the time.
It was pretty good.
And then in 39, well, I was in the active militia there. But in 39, well, I joined the Grenadiers. Mm-hmm.
What did you do in the Grenadiers?
Well, right after joining, I went on an infantry refresher course. Then I was attached to the PPCLI as an instructor.
Where did you take your course?
The refresher course in Fort Osborne Barracks. Then I was attached to the PPCLI as an instructor on infantry training. And I was recalled to duty as Provost Marshal, not Provost Sergeant, in Winnipeg. I was on that for a while, and then I was called in by the Colonel and told, there's your battalion, drill them. So I drilled the battalion, and I was promoted to CSM. Mm-hmm. I was put in the C Company. Mm-hmm. Major Clark was the company commander I knew very well, so we got along fearlessly.
Good commander?
He was a good commander. He was a good officer. He was a First World War officer.
How was the condition of the Grenadiers? Were they fairly well trained?
For the work they did, the work that was expected of them to do at that time, they were well trained.
But they were not experienced soldiers.
They weren't experienced. How many Canadian soldiers were experienced in 1939? We had a mutilus here, or a train cater, of about 2,100, all ranks throughout Canada. So how well can you expect a battalion to be trained? We recruited the battalion, I think we were the first battalion to be at full strength. We moved into Fort Osborne Barracks and remained the winter there on winter training, such as horse route marches, drill, weapons training, which we didn't have any of at the time. We were a machine gun battalion, we didn't have machine guns. We didn't have machine gun vehicles or anything else. We used to draw the picture on the floor and that was it.
So many of the soldiers never handed live ammunition or machine gun?
Oh, yes. During the next spring, early in the next spring, my company, anyway, were all put through machine guns and Bren gun and the rifle at St. Charles Ranges. Not that it was qualified or anything else, but the type of gun we had just wasn't really suitable.
Mm-hmm.
They were never tested. Well, there was the odd brand, the Vickers, and the rifle. And the new anti-tank rifle that was out, it was an O'Reilly, I mean.
You never got near it?
No, they were phased out, that anti-tank rifle. Well, after the winter's training, which as I say was mostly in the drill halls, inside training, in April 1940, my company, along with A Company, went off to Jamaica. We were the first company to land in there. A Company remained in Bermuda. My company went on to Jamaica, and we were the advance party. We cleaned up the mess that was left because the British had moved out overnight in a hurry, and the barracks were clear. You know, not a soul in them, but it was a mess. You take a battalion moving 24-hour notice, they have to move. I cleaned that up, and then the rest of the battalion came in, and that was it. Our duties in Jamaica were garrison duties. Although I got quite a break, I was put on Marina's assistant to the... He was at that time the Attorney General of Jamaica, who looked after all alien property. And I was put on as his assistant for a while. We used to board the Jamaica Producer, which was a ship there, and go around to different islands in the Caribbean and all over the place and pick up Germans and bring them back into the internment camp there. We started off with a dozen. I think we finished up with 2,700. But our job was purely garrison. Spit and polish. And I think everybody had a good time while they were in Jamaica.
Yes.
We all learned a lot. That we were not ready. We didn't do very much training. And we weren't ready for what we came to. Although, while we were in the hills in Jamaica, we did a certain amount of training, but you'd be up the hills for 1 month, and down on the plains for about four. They didn't do much training. The odd, you know, parades and one thing.
So
didn't.
You actually had no, you had no war maneuvers or anything like
Pardon?
That.
Pardon?
Had no maneuvers or anything like that.
No maneuvers whatsoever. No, there was no maneuvers. Company training, that's as far as we got. Never got to battalion training.
No.
Or brigade training or divisional or anything else. It was all companies as far as we got. Because the demands on the battalion while we were there, we had about seven different types of guards, and it took more than one company, and a company was 147 all ranks to maintain the guards. And we had a number, a great number, sick with different diseases that
like
you get when you're abroad.
Hmm? Yeah,
well, dinghy is not a bad thing. Dinghy is something that comes and goes.
Yeah.
You get dinghy fever. It's like prickly heat to start with, and you get a great temperature with it. But you drink a pint of rum, and you go to sleep, and the next morning your dinghy's gone. The dinghy is really nothing to worry about. It's caused from a mosquito.
Oh, yeah.
But it's nothing to worry about. We had a lot of sports, a lot of activities, tried to keep everybody busy. But insofar as military training concerned, we didn't have it.
Men were a good bunch of men, though, all over average?
Overall, I'd say they were, yes. Mm-hmm. Lack training, and a lot of them very disappointed.
They're expecting to go to England,
didn't they? Yeah, well, they were expecting to go overseas, and we were shut off down there. Well, naturally, you're going to be disappointed. And I know I was. I was wanting to get back. I had a couple of brothers who wanted to have five brothers altogether. Two of them were killed, and one, he just died last year. He was wounded, I think, seven times throughout the African campaign all the way through. But we just didn't get that opportunity. And we were disgusted. You know, you'd hear the BBC news. You never hear Canadian news down there, but BBC news, you'd get it every night. And the British, those that were left there, that have their ears glued to that wireless, as they call it. And we'd hear about this, that, and the other. And here we are sitting out there. Everybody feels badly. And then when we did leave, well, we came back here and were pushed into the Robinson building. And after 2 weeks worth, there was truckloads and truckloads of equipment came in there. We issued new equipment, the same style as we'd handed in, and sent off to Hong Kong.
Did you have an inkling you were going to Hong Kong?
No, we didn't know where we were going. It was absolute secrecy until we reached Vancouver. And then the officers and warrant officers had a meeting. And then we knew we were going to China, Hong Kong. But nobody else knew. We boarded the Awatea, an Australian ship, in Vancouver. There was a shortage of officers. Warrant officers had a do-orderly officer. And the first morning aboard, I was orderly officer. And our duties were to go around the different mess decks to see if there was any complaints about breakfast. Well, when you put a brigade on a ship and give them a hammock for the first time to sleep in, you know, that's bad enough in all the lower decks. But when they serve this miserable mutton sausage for breakfast, I'm telling you, and the grease was on there, it was really more than I could take. I just went down the companionway and I hollered any complaints, and I just got a horde of shouts and sausages thrown at me.
I wonder you didn't get the sausage thrown at you.
I did. Oh, they were thrown everything. And at noon that day, the same thing happened. I wrote down any complaints, and that's mutton stew. So that was the end of that. I think we would have had a real riot aboard ship had we just kept that mutton on board. But the mutton was taken off, and I understand the beef was put on. But the mutton isn't the thing to feed Canadians. If they're hungry, all right. And if it's hot, it's fine. But once it gets that scum on the top, you know, the grease, mm-hmm. it forms up.
And
it's not palatable.
And if the cooks don't know how to cook it properly?
Oh, I think the Australian cooks knew how to cook it. Perhaps they didn't know how to cook it in such bulk.
Mm-hmm.
Because this was the first time the Awatea was used as a troop ship. She was a very nice ship, mm-hmm. a luxury liner, and converted into a troop ship. And I think this was her first trip.
Now, when you were going to Hong Kong, did you have any forebodings? Because you had been in China, hadn't you?
None whatever, no.
Had you been watching the Japanese occupation of China?
No, I don't think so, no.
Mm-hmm.
We hadn't been interested in that. We had been more or less isolated for 18 months prior to that.
Mm-hmm.
And there was very few newspapers came through. And we're more or less watching the British in our own fronts rather than the Chinese and the Japanese.
This regiment that was pulled out of Hong Kong before you, or was there a regiment pulled out of Hong Kong when you
were? No, there was no regiment pulled out of Hong Kong
mm-hmm.
prior to us going. The Navy pulled out.
Mm-hmm.
But the garrison in Hong Kong was always a brigade. We had the Indian regiments, the two British regiments, the Royal Scots and the
Middlesex,
yeah, along with some artillery and a few airmen, British airmen, that was, along with the troop, corps troops and things like that. But there was no army, no regiments pulled out there. There's only enough room there for the, that small garrison. Other than that, it's not really needed. But we weren't told anything about this until we reached the Philippines. And then Colonel Sutton got us together and told us all about what to expect. From Manila on, the ship, she zigzagged in the war pattern. You know, ships going in war without escorts. Well, we had an escort, but they always zigzag and take a long path around. And he told us that then, that we may have to fight our way off the ship. We took it like a grain of salt, because we weren't issued ammunition, we weren't issued anything before we came off the ship.
Was there another boat with equipment
on it? Not to my knowledge. I've heard so many things people saying, well, the other ship was left behind. In, it got as far as Manila or somewhere like that, and war was declared, it was left behind. But I have no knowledge of that. As far as carriers and everything else, I have no knowledge. We were then an infantry battalion. We were equipped with Bren guns, rifles, 2 and 4 inch mortars. And that was the equipment of an infantry regiment. The only bad part about it, we didn't have any ammunition other than smoke for the 4-inch mortars. We didn't have any high explosives or anything like that with the 4-inch. So the mortar platoon just had smoke. Mm-hmm. But each platoon had 1 2-inch mortar and 3 Bren gun and the rifles. We were, insofar as infantry, we were complete with equipment. Mm-hmm. I've heard tales of this ship being left behind there.
No gun carriers, no tanks, crews, so I mean, there's just no.
You don't have to use an infantry.
No, you don't. No.
I mean, infantry is made up of hand weapons.
That's right.
Shoulder controlled and mm-hmm. other weapons. So we had a full complement of weapons as far as I know. Mm-hmm.
And if you did have heavier artillery, how would it have been maneuverable on that island?
Heavy artillery?
Mm-hmm.
Heavy artillery would have been fine on the island, but to get the amount of artillery to offset the core artillery that the Japs had on Lion's Head just 2 miles from us would have been a terrible idea of getting it there, because they had core artillery there, something like 200 pieces of artillery, where we had, 1 battery of howitzers and 1 18-inch battery, plus a bunch of dummy guns and the big howitzer on the at Stanley. It was absolutely useless. It was definitely for shore defense. And the Japanese knew everything about the island. They knew more than we knew. And they knew that gun was there. They could have put it out of action if they'd come in range, because their cruisers came in there. Their bombers flew over every 2 hours. And they could have knocked all that out of action.
Mm-hmm. What did you do when you arrived to Hong Kong before the war?
Before the war
started.
Start in training.
Mm-hmm.
We start in training. We had, I had 34 replacements in my company. Some of them only had, 20 days we spent on the boat service, where they were training and weapon training there, and 10 days at Port La Prairie, and a week absent over that 10 days. So they had very little training. So we had to start in training these lads.
Did you get to know all the island yourself? Were you taking out an orientation course?
We won the island once. We all had our manning areas. And we familiarized ourselves with that area, how to get there, the vulnerable points from that area. But that's all we did. E Company went, I think, Happy Valley, B Company, Park Fulham, C Company, Aberdeen, D Company, I don't know where they went. Headquarters was in Wan Chai Gap. E Company was scattered all over. But we were there over about 24 period before the actual manning of the island. But the Japanese knew more about it than we did. But we settled down into the barracks, and we started training as much as we possibly could. There was no training areas in that area where we were in Kowloon. There was no way you could train troops or anything like that. We never saw or heard anything of the Japs. Anything of the Japs while we were there. So we didn't know anything about them. Of course, they were only a stone throw away, maybe. But nobody knew about them. But we did as much training as we possibly could.
Did your commanding officer talk to you then and tell you how serious the situation was or anything like that?
No. I don't think that's the position of the camp command officer.
Pardon?
That's not the position of the camp commanding officer, to get his men together and tell them what a precarious position we're in. For instance, he has too many men to speak to at one time. He got a hold, no doubt, of his officers, company commanders, sergeants, and platoon commanders, and briefed them on it. But below that, they never said a word about it. Mm-hmm. But we manned our positions for, I'd say, 24 hours. Prior to the outbreak of hostilities. We didn't get to know too much about it.
Where were you positioned?
Aberdeen.
Aberdeen.
The reservoir, is that it? The reservoir and the roads leading down into the village of Aberdeen.
Oh, yes.
There's not a great deal we could do down there. There was a small place in a small island, and there was mostly fishermen in there, and the whole area was packed tight with sandpan dwellers by the thousand in there. There's not a great deal you could do in there. That was our position. They called it the Aberdeen Reservoir. It was our real position.
Would that be a position that would come under heavy bombing?
No, it didn't come under any bombing from air. Strafing, yes. We came in for a lot of strafing, but no bombing. I think that was the only actual water on the island. And if they had destroyed that, well, they would have destroyed the whole island. I don't think they had any idea of doing that. But we got plenty of strafing and light bombing, but not any heavy stuff. Nothing to put the reservoir out. The reservoir stood still all the time. Mortar fire, we got a lot of that from Bennett's Hill and other places. But we didn't get any real damage done to the reservoir.
And you stayed in the reservoir during the whole hostility?
No. We moved out to Park Fulham, which was further down, right on the shore, on the sea coast. We moved down there while there was a big Jap landing moved in there, along with the British and some Wavy Navy.
Mm-hmm. You were there to help back them up, then?
Oh, you? Yes. Mm-hmm.
And was the heavy activity there?
No. I was on the southern side of the island. There was no artillery.
No activity? I mean, quite a bit of...
Oh, there was quite a lot of activity, yes.
A lot of activity. Mm-hmm. Then you saw action in there, right?
Oh, yes.
Mm-hmm. Were you injured in any way?
No, just slightly.
Slightly. What was it?
Just a little bit of
shrapnel
here and there.
Mm-hmm. And how did your men fare?
Pardon?
How was your number?
Oh, I lost some. I lost about 7 or 8, and there was quite a number wounded. Of course, once hostilities really started, there was no organization. I mean, I shouldn't say this, but there wasn't any really organization. The Japs tapped all wires, they tapped all phones, the field telephones, everything were tapped. They knew the codes, knew everything. And as far as organized, there wasn't any. We were spread out over a whole batch of land with different objectives in view, and I'd say the front would be too much even for a battalion to look after, especially in that rough terrain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
You know, if you've got straight land, prairie or something like that, well, you can see what's going on. But when you're in a mountainous country with all bush and trees and rocks and whatnot, you can't see anything.
Mm-hmm. It's almost a resource to guerrilla
tactics. It is guerrilla tactics, definitely. The only way they knew, the only fighting they ever did was guerrilla fight.
And they were good fighters too.
They were very good. Mm-hmm. We laughed at them the first time we saw them. You know, I had these running shoes with the big toe separate from the rest of the foot, you know. And they all carried a length of rope on the side of their coats, and they had a sloppy little bit of equipment, 2 or 3 pouches and a bandolier strung over the shoulder, 3 or 4 bags of rice strung to one side with maybe 2 or 3 pieces of sugar. And that was them. Sloppy to look at, but magnificent. They could climb anything. They were well trained, and of course they were fanatics.
Mm-hmm.
You know, the Banzai boys, they were really fanatics. But nobody could knock them. I think their rifles were much better than those, higher powered. They're a smaller caliber, and I think they carried a lot for them too.
But those were seasoned troops.
Oh yes, they were all seasoned fighters. And then they had mountain artillery too, which we didn't have, little 4-pounders, you know, where the we used to have them in mountain batteries, where a man takes a wheel and straps it across his shoulder. Another one takes a wheel and straps it, and then another 2 carry the tail, another 2 carry the barrel. It takes them a few minutes to assemble this thing. And they fire 3 or 4 shots from there, and then they pull it to another position, and then by the time you get set on your machine gun,
they've moved out,
and they're back in somewhere else. They've got a little more elevation and power is coming over. Also, they were really up on their tactics, you know, as far as their and they made the mortars pay off, but the mortar platoons, the mortar men, those mortars were strapped to the back. One would carry the base plate, and this fellow, the mortar on his back, he'd just squat down, and the base would stretch right in the plate, and fire 2 or 3 rounds, and away they'd go again. One man pick up the plate, another man, 3 or 4 had got the ammunition, one's got the pipe on his back, and away they go. But, they were trained, there's no doubt about it. They were a different type of soldier, what we were.
Mm-hmm.
And they no doubt were fighting for the glory of the country. However, when we got the surrender, it became a big surprise to everyone. We didn't expect it. But we did get it. And it was Christmas Day, day after. Oh, we were still firing at 7 o'clock at night, Christmas Day. But we got that, and we had to pack in. I don't know whether we were rejoicing or we're sorry. You know, you've got that mixed feeling. Are you happy that you're going to have a good chance of living, or are you just going to carry on and they'll wipe you out? Which they could have done. The amount of troops they had with the Air Force, the Navy, and the amount of troops they had, they could have wiped us off the face of the earth in 2 days flat. Mm-hmm. However, we did surrender, and we hung around getting cleaned up a bit, because a lot of lads hadn't shaved or anything else, and gather up what equipment, clothing, odds and ends you could find. And then we moved in and give ourselves up. That was pretty scary too. This one?
We'll have break now.
Japanese machine guns were placed there. And these Japanese, without officers, you know, in command of them, they got no more thought of letting you go by or nothing. We could just press that trigger and say goodbye to you all. Oh, we did make it. And I had about 6 men with me at the time. And they wrapped me up with telephones. Field telephones, you know, a box about as big as your speakers there, with a telephone and about 6 foot of wire. They wrapped the wire all around my neck and made me carry about 4 of these telephones up Bennett's Hill. They give other fellows, tied them up with different things that we grew up there. We didn't know what to expect, really. The first night we saw some awful sights moving in, atrocities, everything else. And then we moved into the university and stayed there that night. The following day the Japs came round and moved us out down to North Point Camp.
When you saw these atrocities, were you worried about the welfare of yourself and your men?
Yes. Mm-hmm. I was worried about it at all times. I think that got me in a lot of severe trouble, being worried about my men rather than myself.
Mm-hmm.
I was known as a bastard.
Oh, yeah.
And a tough sergeant major. But I don't know, I think it paid off. A lot of men came to me since told me they would have survived if they hadn't have gone along my way. But I was worried about them after they got in, the younger fellows especially.
Yeah.
Lads had never been away from home, things like that. Green kids, you know, we had a lot of them. Some of them were only 15 and a half, 16 at that time. And you have to worry about them. And I was really worried about them. Did everything I could to help them. Hauled them along, and one thing or another, but they made out, most of them. Although we moved back from there, we moved back into Kowloon. and then moved back again to North Point. Why they did all this moving, you know, I think it was more or less showing us off. You know, we marched up there in triumph 3 weeks previous. And we marched up like beaten dogs 3 weeks later under the command of the Japs.
That plays a lot in the Japanese mentality, doesn't it?
Oh, yes, that is Japanese mentality. As long as they can press you down and keep you there while they're quite happy. As long as they're not the underdog. I think that's all they did it for. The marches up there, the marches back, the marches up, the marches back. Just to show us off, you know.
Mm-hmm.
The big goose stepping Jap. When we went into Kowloon barracks, I forget the name, but we had a work party at Kai Tak Airport, which there was a lot of sabotage. One thing now I think of, a bicycle had landed while we went through the cement because there was some places where we were mixing bags of cement and putting in a runway. It was perhaps three times as wide as this room, but we were putting in slabs 8x8. An 8x8 slab would put in about 2 shovelfuls of cement and bring it to the top, and it was all gravel washed away. A lot of trouble on that. But we used to have to get up at 4 o'clock in the morning and board this ship and go round the course and then get off and march a couple of miles down. There was what they called the Holy Hill there previously, and we dug all that hill down by hand to reclaim land in order to build the airport. The airport still stands today, I think, of course, it's been rebuilt, but we reclaimed a tremendous amount of land there. I'll never forget one day, though. We used to get, in the afternoon, a supply of biscuits, arrowroot biscuits, 2 per man, a cup of sloppy, watery stuff we called coffee or tea. And the Hanshaw, or the leader, used to have to go up to the Japanese and tell them how many men you have. Well, I had 60 men on the work party, and I told them 120. I was thinking of 120 biscuits, because you've got to be very, very careful when you're dealing with men, that you had to have 2 biscuits per man, and each one had to be a perfect biscuit.
Mm-hmm.
So I said 120, and I got a double issue. Well, I didn't know what to do. Over, I hit it. And I got back in the camp. We had a lot of sick friends at that time. There was a lot of diphtheria and dysentery and everything at that time. And what the beriberi hadn't set in, but pellagra, dysentery, and diphtheria had. So I thought, well, rather than give each man 4 and take a chance, because the Japs were all around, you have to keep them. And I kept them, managed to come into camp and distribute them there. But I was good and scared that day, going in with 120 biscuits.
And it's funny, the person who doled it out didn't realize that somewhere along the line.
Well, they had sacks and sacks of it. It was all the stuff that was stolen from us in the first place.
Mm-hmm.
But I was scared that day. Over next, I was put in hospital then. I had dysentery and several other things wrong with me. So I was sent to Bone Road Hospital. I stayed there for a period of time. There was no treatment in the hospital. The only thing is you had a bed to lay on. That was really cushy. And your food was the same, only it was served up differently and cooked differently. But insofar as medicines or anything is concerned, there wasn't any. You just took potluck and you got well, or you didn't get well. For I arrived back in camp. They had moved and again from Kowloon back in camp North Point. And the day after I moved back in, I had a charpoy made up, and I was having a little rest in the afternoon. There was nothing to do. And in came six Japanese and a sergeant. And the sergeant had his big sword drawn, and the six Japs had fixed bayonets and one thing and another, and they hollered at me to get up. All I had on was a pair of shorts and a pair of go-heads. I didn't know what it was all about anyway. And I was set in the center of these six men with a sergeant leading. Off went up to the guard room. I was marched in front of the camp commandant and tried for aiding and abetting escape. Now, I knew nothing of this escape because I'd never heard of it yet. Well, there was two men in my company that had escaped and were shot in doing so, shot while we were in the water. So I was charged. And it was the funniest thing, comic opera, really comic. I mean, if you saw it on the screen today, you'd laugh, so would I. The camp commandant, he was, they all had drawn swords, and the others were standing behind there with their fixed bayonets right on your back, you know. And he read off the scroll, big parchment, reading it off. You know, in the Japanese, we didn't understand a word of it at the time. And the interpreter was interpreted. But I, in charge of this company, while these men had escaped, and I was charged with aiding and abetting escape, I was duly tried and sentenced by Colonel Toponaki in the Kowloon Hotel to serve a term in prison. It didn't say how long or anything else. A term of imprisonment. And finally, the camp commandant said, through the interpreter, "Have you anything to say for yourself?" And I said, "Yes, sir." And that's all I said. I got a butt of a rifle on my back. And I was going to defend myself, saying that I was in hospital at the time. I was 7 miles away when this thing happened. But I got the butt of a rifle and down I went. I got up again and they put the chains on me, marched me off. Just a pair of shorts on, a pair of go-heads, wooden clog thing. So I said, "Well, can't I get a toothbrush or shirt or something like that?" Mm-hmm. So they put me, they marched me off and they put me in a cell. It was 5x5. And we stayed there.
How many
were you? 3 of us in this cell. It was old Harry McNaughton. He used to march 3 paces and you'd hit the wall. 3 paces the other way, you'd hit the wall. All my heart, all my heart. Of course, Harry had a bad heart. He was an old man. And Fred Adams was no young man either. And he had just come out of Bone Road Hospital because he had half his hand shot off. Never were. And we got a bowl of rice in the morning and a bowl of rice at night with a pot of hot water and lots of mouthwash.
What?
Mouthwash, Condi's fluid. Mm-hmm. We could get all of that we wanted. Although after a number of days, I had dysentery still. There was no toilet facilities, no water, no wash basin, no nothing. Just a square room with a cement floor and a rat hole. And 3 of us in it. We each had a half blanket. It was cold too. There was no glass in the window or anything. When they let us out, you know how many days were, just about 10 days. Went out into the courtyard outside and the sergeant could speak English, and he says, "I want you to thank the camp commandant for the excellent treatment you received while you were in detention." I spoke up again. I had big mouth. I got hit again. I don't know how long I was out, but I was out. "Come to you." And they give us each a cigarette and then march it back to the camp. That was that. After that, we were tagged as Dammy. And that stayed with us all the way through.
What?
Dammy, no good. And that stayed with us all the time we were prisoner of war. Mm-hmm. Were Dammy guys. And you could never get rid of it. As soon as I got to Japan, I was pointed out. Hachiban Dammy Dana. And you couldn't get away from it.
So you were more severely watched and so forth,
right? Mm-hmm. And I was a leader, a hancho, and it was bad for me to be watched. Although I did my share of stealing, the same as the rest of the men. You know, what we could steal, little bits of food, bentos, fish and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. Where were you sent to in Japan?
I was just outside Tokyo for most of the time. We worked in the shipyards there. And after the bombing there, we were shipped to northern Japan in Kamishi. That's where we landed up at the end of the war at Kamishi. It was just a camp settled in the mountains with a stream running by, and there was nothing there. There we worked in the iron mines. We had to... There were two shifts. We were the D shift. We had to leave camp at 5:30 in the morning, march about 3 miles to the, and then climb 500 meters to get to the level we were working at, then go in and do our day's work and come back out and march back. But it was quite an experience. How these men did it, you know. They were skin and bone, and the food we got was, there was nothing in it. Perhaps as much calories as you have for breakfast. And yet they were able to go there and work in the mines and do the share there. How they did it, I don't know. Well, how we all did it, I don't know. Some that didn't survive, I think, gave in. A lot of them gave in the early part of the war. They just couldn't take it.
When you were taken prisoner, did you have a premonition that it would be a good long stay?
No. At that time, Britain had sent or put the fear of God into the Far East by sending the dreadnought, the Prince of Wales. You remember the Prince of Wales? Well, that was the, putting the fear into the East. And we didn't figure that it was going to be long. We figured with her there and Shan Shek, or whatever his name is, we would be out pretty shortly. Rumors, you know, carried on, that he was coming down on his white horse to liberate the South and one thing and another. And the Americans were always close at hand. The 7th Fleet was coming in, and the British fleet from Malaya was coming in. However, they never got there.
What did you do in the shipyard? What was your job in the shipyard?
My job, Hanshaw. I was a foreman.
Mm-hmm.
Being a section leader, as they call it, or a Hanshaw. I was in charge of 60 men, and they were split into different gangs, into we worked in the Zoki section, the machine section. We had the boiler shop, the machine shop, and everything like that. And I used to have to look after these men to see that that's all there was to it. Of course, I used to do my work too. When I got into trouble, well, I'd be put to work.
Mm-hmm.
I got into trouble several times there. I got mad at a fool man one day. A fool man is absolutely nothing. He's a scum of the earth. I think he's a reject from the army. Couldn't get in the army, something like that, but he had a white band on his arm with a mark on it. And he carried a great big stick. And they loved to beat you with it. And I couldn't take it. And I was there about 3 days when I hit the first fool man. I was in trouble there. I was tied up overnight for that. And, but I couldn't, I mean, they're soldiers, yes, you little respect for them. And they respected you. Even the workers respected us, we respected them to a certain extent, after we got to know them. But these women, nobody had any respect for them. And they threw their weight around, or their sticks around. There was another time when a fool man caught me smoking. They tied me up in front of the blast furnace all day. Little things like that. You know. Horrible little creatures. You know.
Little petty things.
Yeah. But anything these fool men saw you do, then they watched you like a hawk. And they'd be right at you. And they had the power to do this. They tied me in front of a blast furnace, an oil furnace one day. And I couldn't turn my head or anything else. I just had to look into this oil blast all day long. I couldn't see for a couple of days.
Blinded you.
Yeah. But they delighted in that. They were filthy little creatures.
Did they ever play tricks on you, like give you hope to build up about something that you were just a...
The Japanese?
Yes.
No. Never build your hopes up about anything. They would rather knock you down than build your hopes up. I mean, mentally.
Mm-hmm.
They'd rather, I mean, the Japanese news, one thing or another, was always detrimental to the outcome. Detrimental to the Allies rather than our good. If they lost a bunch of ships or they lost a bunch in the air or they lost an island, they would always give you the reverse on the radios, one thing or another. But you could always tell by the feeling of the worker and the soldier towards you that how things really went. I mean, their attitude just changed.
Mm-hmm.
And it wouldn't last long. They would change maybe for a day. Next year, they're as right as rain again.
Mm-hmm. You ever even come to this Campbell's spell?
Campbell's, you're darn right, isn't it? I encountered him. I got a swat from him, too.
Mm-hmm.
And he could hit.
Mm-hmm.
I got a wallop from him because of a man, George Maha. He's deputy superintendent heading the jail now. I was taking a work party out. It was pitch dark in the morning. And all my section came to attention, to number. You had to give your commands in Japanese. And all the section came to attention, number, with the exception of one man. And he's standing on the... He's talking to the fellows behind him. And Kamloops came along, and he didn't speak in English, he just jabbered in Chinese and Japanese, and he walloped me. And he walked around the section, and he got to Maha and knocked him out. So But he was a dilly, that man. Oh, he was a terrible man. Kamloops. He was hung anyway, wasn't he? It was a good thing. Yeah. He was a big man too. You know, big, strapping man that had a lot of training in Canada with the RCMP and Mountain and all like that.
Did you see any deaths that were caused by torture?
Pardon?
Any deaths that were caused by, as a result of torturing or anything?
Atrocities?
No, deaths in the camp caused by torture, not of civilians in your own camp.
No. No. No, I never saw any deaths in the camp. By starvation and other things, yeah, lack of treatment, lack of facilities, lack of food, plenty. But not by torture. I saw many atrocities in China with the Chinese women and the Chinese men and things like that. But they were mostly Formosans that were doing this. We had a Formosan battalion guarding us, and they were bloodthirsty people. And they did some vile things, you know. The women that were pregnant, slitting their stomachs open and stuff like that. But not to men. I've seen many beatings. I've had many beatings, but not real torture. Tying you up is torture, yeah. Mm-hmm. Putting you in the cage is torture. Mm-hmm. They had what they called the bird cage that they used to put us in. And there was one night for a week there, there was 10 sections in the camp. And every section commander in the camp had to go into that bird cage for a week. And it's built of bamboo poles, just like a birdcage, hung up off the floor. And you had to go in there and stay in overnight, and out in the morning back to work.
What was the size of it?
Oh, it was about, I'd say 10 by 10. There's enough room for us to sit down and squat like this. Mm-hmm. And that was all. And that was all over. Someone had a jacket, an army jacket that they had thrown over the fence. And nobody knew who it was. It was a Middlesex jacket. There was no Middlesex in the camp. And that jacket was thrown over the fence and nobody would own up to it. And that's what happened to them. All put in there for a week.
They had funny, petty little rules then.
Oh, the rules were very petty. Well, the same with their own people. When you live with people for 4 years and you learn their ways, and their ways of, it was corporal punishment and one thing, they were very petty. Take a person that's, well, the traffic there, you'd have to see it to understand it. There was no trucks, only army vehicles, and the actual needed, what was really needed for industry. But you may never see a truck for 2 miles or a car for 2 miles. But there was all kinds of bicycles and lots of pedestrians, and there was the gimpy or the police on traffic duty. And some poor soul would step off the curb, and he's got his hand held up like that. And he'd holler them over to him, and he'd take out his sword, and he'd whack them 5 or 6 times. And they'd bow to him, and away they'd go. That was their methods. If in the factory a man did something wrong, the foreman would take it out on him. And so on. That's their way of doing things. It seems petty to us, but they were all regimented, and that's the way it lived.
Where were you on liberation?
In Kamishi, just outside Kamishi.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't get out till late. It was about the last camp out there. There was no transportation by rail. The only way you could get in there is by rail. The roads were blown out. It was right in the mountains. The railroads were blown out. And there was no way out unless you walked a couple of hundred miles to into Tokyo or somewhere like that. A lot of the men asked at the time if they could leave, so we had to leave. For two or three days they came back foot sore and weary and hungry and tired. The mountains were practically impassable, and with no roads to follow, they could follow the railroad for a certain period of time, and a bridge was blown out and they'd have to go down a deep gorge and climb up the other side, do the same thing time and time again. Well, they weren't conditioned to do that. I mean, they were conditioned to work with the hands and one thing or another, but to move into the legs were a different proposition. So they came back, most of them. But we were quite a while before we were liberated. Although we didn't suffer, we B-29s used to fly over the camp every other day and drop maybe 20 parachutes. And they were loaded with cases of cigarettes, big car, you know, monstrous packing cases, cigarettes, soups, canned meats, canned fish, canned milk, canned everything. Chocolate bars, chewing gum, everything, bundles of clothing. We were sitting on the bench one day. Our bungalows were just like horse stalls. You had a wooden trestle table in the center, and a stall on this side and a stall on that side. You had 14 men sleep on each side, top and bottom. And we were just, old Paddy Keenan and I were sitting there one day, about noon, and over came the B-29s. We said, oh, here they come, we'll go and watch them. With something to see. My job just at that time, one of these drums came through the ceiling, or through the roof, and landed about a foot in front of us, through the table, and dug right into the cinder floor. Well, there was two drums, 50-gallon gas drums welded together, and they were full of canned goods. They made a hole about that deep in the floor. It just dropped right in front of the party. The war's over, but this is it. And we used to get the Japs to go out and bring them out the hills. If the wind, you know, we'd come through a corridor, and sometimes the wind would catch them, and they'd blow off course and one thing. The Japs used to go and pick them up. And the parachute silks, there's an enormous amount of silk in a parachute. We used to trade that off for sake and stuff like that. And the women were all too ready to give anything they wanted for a strip of parachute silk. But sake was the main thing. The only things they thought of there was eating and drinking. Women didn't enter the mind. Sex wasn't anywhere in the whole of the camp, you know. So we got several different things for parachute silk. Of course, you could get anything you wanted out of the house, knickknacks or anything for. Chocolate bars, parachute, or canned meat or something.
People
like
were
that.
Quite hungry themselves, weren't they?
Well, they were as bad as we were. That's why the war ended. I don't think it was. Well, the atomic bombs definitely. But they were as hungry as we were at all times. They were on the same rations practically as we were. Maybe they had a little more variety. A little more fish, a little more daikons, and instead of getting the the top of the vegetables, perhaps they got the root of the vegetable. But their food was just as skimpy as ours, practically. And they had to depend on the factory for all they got. They couldn't go to a store and buy sugar or anything else. It was all issued from the factory. Fruit, any fruit that came in, it would be divided from the top, would get the big share, and so on and so on, you know, until it reached the bottom man, he got the pickings. Yeah. The same with if a fish boat managed to get in, the same thing. I never saw meat issued there. There was the odd horse that died, or the odd bullock. We used to do most of the transportation with the old oxen, one thing or another. Well, they dropped dead in their tracks. Well, that would be fed to some camp. But I never saw meat issued there at all. Mm-hmm. Until the war was over, then I think in our camp we got about a dozen pigs and a couple of cows, a bunch of chickens. But there was no way to cook them. We didn't know how to cook them. We had to boil them the same as everything else in the soil. Mm-hmm. We couldn't, you know, there was no thing as roast or fry.
Nice
or
anyway. No nice roasting
ovens. Oh, no. And the meat was stringy anyway.
Oh, just, yeah. Must have been horrible.
I'd been working for 4 years, you know, pulling carts or something. But it was edible. Mm-hmm. We all put on a tremendous amount of weight from the time we were liberated till we reached Victoria.
So we already started to look good?
Oh, we looked good and felt good at that time. I think I was up to, about 186 pounds. Well, I was fat then. And we felt pretty good, although they hospitalized me when I reached Victoria, but we felt pretty good. But we had put on a lot of weight. Mm-hmm. There was nobody going around, you know, the bones rattling or the flesh or the skin sagging. And everybody's hair had grown in by then, and they looked pretty decent by the time they got there. Of course, we were treated well on the way home with the American Navy. You could get all you wanted to eat and all you wanted of everything from them for free. So it was very good.
What did you do when you arrived at that country?
Pardon?
What did you do when you settled down afterwards?
Winnipeg?
Mm-hmm. When you, post-war. No, how did you make out when you settled down after you were discharged, or how long were you?
Oh, I was in hospital for quite a while. Dear Lodge.
What was the matter?
Oh, everything. And nothing. I stayed in Dear Lodge one time for 3 weeks. Never saw a doctor. I got up and walked out. At that time, you know, I mean, all the return men would be in the lodge, and they'd, every night you'd go and get drunk. Mm-hmm. And they'd come up the fire escape into the barracks, and they're not supposed to, and they'd be dropping your heavy ammunition boots on the floor, and you know. But I was in the lodge for quite a while, and I got a leave. I went to see her mother and father in Prince Rupert. I stayed up there about a month. I got fed up with it and I came back, and then they sent me to the H&O Centre at Portage, Health and Occupational Centre at Portage, and filled up there. That was a real workout, you know. You had to ride an army bike, you had to pull the boat in that swamp they call a lake out there, you had to play around the golf every day. Kept you going. And then I started work later in the fall. I got fed up with running back and forth to hospital, and I had the heck with it. And I went to work for the provincial government. And I've been there ever since.
Did you have a hard time adjusting to home life, or did it not bother you too much?
Well, yes and no. I think it was harder on the kids. We had four kids at home, and I think I was harder on them than I realized. And I thought I was a model husband and a father when I come home. You know, but they didn't think so. But no, we got along fine. There was no real. I used to get periods of depression. Mm-hmm. Where I'd go into a depressed state, and I wouldn't speak to anybody, I wouldn't look to anybody, I wouldn't eat these. Why it came on, I don't know. But it came, and through nothing at all, it just came. Mm-hmm. And there was no way I could get rid of it. I went to see Dr. DeLodge, or I told him about it. And he gave me a bunch of pills. And those pills, well, I was going around the days. I was sleeping half the time, so I threw the pills away. Gradually, this depression, periods, it just wore off and wore off. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. But that's about the only thing. Of course, I had trouble with my back and legs. The nurses come back.
How are your eyes?
Well, without the glasses, I don't see. Mm-hmm. Especially the left eye. I had an operation. I got some steel in my left eye there. Mm-hmm. And I had an operation on my eye when I came back. Mm-hmm. But without glasses, I can't see across the room. Mm-hmm.
How do you feel about experience?
Well, I don't know. It's something I wouldn't want to go through again. And it's something that it enriches you because of it. I think it's did me a lot of good. Not that I wanted to be locked up, I didn't deserve to be locked up. But in my line of work in the field of corrections, it's did me a tremendous amount of good. It gives me the right to understand a prisoner's problems more than someone that hasn't been through it.
You work where do you work?
I work at the Vaughan Street.
Mm-hmm.
But I think it gives you an insight into what it is to lose your freedom. Mm-hmm. Actually, that's all these fellows do now. Lose freedom and perhaps self-respect. But we lost everything. Except, not everything. I shouldn't say everything, because if you lost your spirit and what you were there for and what you had to go back to, well, you'd be 2 feet under.
Mm-hmm. Yes, but you came back a hero, not...
Not a hero, no, I was never a hero.
No, but I mean, the people looked upon the Hong Kong vets in a favorable way.
People looked upon you in, I wouldn't say a favorable way, a pitying manner. It was pathetic. I wouldn't go into a store when I came back. I went into Eden's one time to buy a suit, an overcoat. Oh, you poor, as soon as I saw the patch on the shoulder, you poor fellow, well, how did you do that, how did you do? And I got so fed up, I walked out the store.
Mm-hmm.
But I wouldn't say people idolized you or anything. Perhaps it was full of pity. There was a lot of stories going around about atrocities and all that sort of stuff. Well, there was atrocities, no doubt. In a lot of the camps in the northern areas, the coal mines especially.
Yes, I think the coal mines where I was.
Mm-hmm. But while we were in the mines, we were left more or less alone. We had this work to do. And we just used to puddle along and do it. It was hard work, mind you, but we didn't have much supervision. We had to clean out what they called a stope, or we call a stope in the old country. And you had to clean out that stope from the night before and get it ready for the next shift coming in, drillers and things like that. We'd do that, and nobody bothered us. The odd time the guard would come around, and that was all right. Very few of them went in because you water up to your ankles, and you know, forever drip, 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 mm-hmm. water all over the place. And very few of them would go in there.
Very unhealthy.
It was. Mm-hmm. A lot of people got pneumonia. I don't think we suffered as much as the Chinese. They had a Chinese labor battalion working the night shift on the 500 meter level, and we'd work the day shift. Well, they were drillers and people like that. People that were recruited in China that were professional people, you know, drillers and miners. But they suffered more so than us. They had, I don't think they had the same rations. They didn't keep themselves near as clean, and they deteriorated some fierce. It was really terrible, the condition they were in. When we went into their camp, they had lice by the million. Of course, we had our share of them too. Without lice, well, it wasn't so good. But they suffered more so than we did, and they were a labor battalion that was recruited for work, you know, in that area. But they didn't bother us too much, as long as we got that cleaned out. And there was, I think there was 24 of us from the gang, and we had 16 cars to load in a day and push them out, and that was all day's work. But it kept you hopping because there was no shovels or anything to lift this stuff up with. We had a grub hole and a big tree, a wooden tree with a handle on each side, and you'd have to pull the stuff onto this tree and then lift it up and dump it into the box. That is the way we had to load cars.
Very stupid system.
A very stupid system, yeah. But they had no other equipment. Actually, the Japs really, I think they were beaten long before the bombs fell, you know, economically. In the shipyard, it was one of the biggest shipyards in Tokyo. They built nothing at that time but Class B destroyers. They didn't have any tools for cutting steel or anything like that. Everything had to be burned for the settling. And once the tooling ran out, they couldn't remake them because they didn't have hard steel, and they couldn't get any in. So the big saws and the guillotines and all that were lying idle, and the punches. Everything had to be cut with a torch, welded. And anything that had to be drilled by machine. There were no punches. There were punches. So they were really beaten economically.
By the blockade,
with that 7th Fleet in there.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, one time there was one destroyer launched, and she went out in the Tokyo Harbor and sunk right away. That was a blue day.
Did you guys have anything to do with that?
No, that was the Americans.
Oh, I think it. Were there any Americans in your camp?
In our camp? Very few. We had about 6 Americans in one camp, but in the other camp we went to, there were half Americans. Mm-hmm. In our camp we had 500 Canadians, 30 English, about 6 Americans in Tokyo. And the other camp went to, well, was 200 Canadians, about 150 British, and a couple of hundred or so Americans.
Did they treat the Americans any differently?
No differently, no. None whatever. I think the Canadians, they were all treated the same. Canadians, British, American. The Javanese they got a little bit rough treatment, more so than we got, because he belonged to the Southeast Asia, and they wanted to get them into the pack, and these fellas just wouldn't confirm. So I think they got rough treatment.
Did you know Hardy or Harvey or Tugby?
Pardon?
Harvey or Tugby? Were you connected?
Tugby.
Yeah.
No, I knew Tugby before. Mm-hmm. Harvey, I didn't know. No, I wasn't in their camp. Had I been, well, I was senior to both of them, I would have taken over the camp for all of them. But of course, I wouldn't count out of jazz.
No.
And I would have been kicked out, of course. Mm-hmm. But...
you wouldn't count out of jazz. Did they respect you for it?
No. Not really.
No, they just laughed at you.
Mm. They wouldn't bother you. They set you aside and said, if you were a troublemaker, you got in trouble. Or they'd respect it for sure next time. I know many, many scrapes I've been in, and the soldier that let me down, he'd give me a cigarette and give me a light and one thing, another like that. I had a laugh one day. It was on a Yasme day or a day off. We used to get one day a month off. And we had a bath. Well, the bathtub was about as big as this house, you see. One section used to bath all together. The way they heat the water, they'd fill it with water, and you have to go out and buy a bunch of firewood up and put it underneath the cement floor and heat the floor and heat the water. Well, this, yes, we did. There was 10, 11 sections in there together. It was mine and another fellow, Joe Turner, who's an Englishman. And the guard came dashing down to the bathhouse and wanted the hand chores of Jew and Jewish sections. Well, what the hell's the trouble? When they call you like that, well, you're in trouble. Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. So we dashed up to the, put a pair of pants and a shirt on, went up to the camp commandant's office. And he gave us each a loaf of bread and 5 pounds of sugar. But prior to doing that, you know, they're real show-offs. And he gets up and he gives us a great speech, you know, how about in Japanese. And it seems to work out, you know, 10 times the length of our sentences. Or what it was interpreted as, the camp commandant was pleased with the leaders of 10, 11 section because they looked after the men much better than any other men in the camp. Would you please accept this token of gratitude from him? Big loaf of bread and a bag of sugar. About 5 pounds of sugar. You know, I think we could have both fell right through that floor. We were expecting trouble. Because the day before there was an air raid, and I had an old sweater, and I traded it to a fellow at work for a dozen eggs. Well, we used to wear the Japanese clothes, they cast off clothing, you know, and the pantaloons. There was no way to take the eggs in, because when you went in the camp from work, you'd have to strip off your jacket, strip off your shirt, drop your pants. Well, you're all right as long as you just drop them to about here, because the eggs would be further down. However, we're just getting ready to leave when the air raid sounded. And when the air raid siren went, we had about 3 miles to travel back to camp, and we had to run all the way. Well, you can figure how my eggs were when I got into camp.
Sort of scrambled.
Good thing these pants were tight around your leg, you know, and they were all in there. So we just had to get our socks and open up the pants and let it run onto the socks. But it was just the day, well, one search. That was a good time to get any contraband in when the air raid siren was on, because they didn't search you. They locked you in the camp and they got the hell out of it. Well, they didn't search you, but there's eggs, 6 in each leg. That would have been a marvelous feast, you know. It was, in fact. But it was the day after when we asked, you know, for all this trouble. Maybe they picked up the nip that got my sweater and he squawked that it was me and I'm in trouble. But that's what he gave me, a loaf of bread and this bag of sugar. Well, being the best times for looking after your men. However, it doled out that everybody got 2 teaspoonfuls of sugar in the sections, in both our sections, and a half a slice of bread each. Just, you know, just a taste of bread.
That's a little change.
Hmm?
That's a little change.
It's something. I mean, the men really thought that was great. But you couldn't take that and put it on your shelf. Well, the rats would get it. The men didn't get it. The rats would get it anyway. You couldn't keep anything there for rats. And you had to eat it. Get it tight so nobody would hang it from a string so the rats couldn't get down the string. But it was quite a letdown, or a build up, I should say, when he said that and he gave us this bag of sugar. Oh my God. I just felt, you know, tears coming to your eyes. It was a feast. Oh no, you asked me, dear, to get 2 teaspoonfuls of sugar, but you couldn't hide anything from men, and it was impossible for you to sit among men that you're commanding and eat bread and sugar and have them with nothing. You couldn't do it. They'd murder you anyway. If they didn't steal it from you, then the rats would get it, so we used to dish everything out like that. Mm-hmm. Anything we bought, any contraband that was brought in, had to be shared with the sick. Anybody that was bedridden, that was stayed in the bed, they'd get whatever you stole, part of it. A fish head or something like that. It was all right boiled, a fish head, if you didn't boil it. And it'd give you some taste.
The monotony of the rice and the barley was just terrible.
Oh, the monotony of that. Had there been salt, you know, something with it, it would have been all right. But the odd time we stole salt, we got this, it was just made from the sea in big crystals, you know, mm-hmm. Like brown salt. I think we use it, here for something.
Mm-hmm.
And we'd steal a big block of it. And you see men sucking on it.
Mm-hmm.
The salt was something you really missed, you know.
Mm-hmm. Your body needed it.
You needed it, yeah. Because you perspired a lot. It was hot there in the summertime.
Mm-hmm.
And you perspired quite a great deal.
Did you ever have any feelings to go back to Japan?
Never, no. I was quite disappointed. I used to read a lot. Geography in different countries. And we had a bath. Well, the bathtub was about as big as this house, you see. One section is the bath, all together. The way they heat the water, they fill it with water, and you have to go out and buy a bunch of firewood up and put it underneath the cement floor and heat the floor and heat the water. Well, this, yes, we did. There was 10, 11 sections in there together. It was mine and another fellow, Joe Turner, who's an Englishman. And the guard came dashing down to the bathhouse and wanted the hand chores of Jew and Jewish sections. Well, what the hell's the trouble? When they call you like that, well, you're in trouble. Hurry up, hurry up, hurry up. So we dashed up to the, put a pair of pants and a shirt on, went up to the Camp Cummins office. And he gave us each a loaf of bread and 5 pounds of sugar. But prior to doing that, you know, they're real show-offs. And he gets up and he gives us a great speech, you know, but in Japanese. And it seems to work out, you know, 10 times the length of our sentences. Or what it was interpreted as, the camp commandant was pleased with the leaders of 10, 11 section because they looked after the men much better than any other men in the camp. Would you please accept this token of gratitude from him? Big loaf of bread and a bag of sugar, about 5 pounds of sugar. You know, I think we could have both fell right through that floor.
We were expecting
trouble. Because the day before there was an air raid, and I had an old sweater, and I traded it to a fellow at work for a dozen eggs. Well, we used to wear the Japanese clothes, they cast off clothing, you know, and the pantaloons. There was no way to take the eggs in, because when you went in the camp from work, you'd have to strip off your jacket, strip off your shirt, drop your pants. Well, you're all right as long as you just drop them to about here, because the eggs would be further down. However, we're just getting ready to leave when the air raid sounded. And when the air raid siren went, we had about 3 miles to travel back to camp, and we had to run all the way. Well, you can figure what happened.